From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Arena Football League announced this week that they're canceling their 2009 season. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest sports casualty of the American economy. Also, the story of the NBA's perilous beginnings, an NHL season update, and the story of the Big Bad Bruins' emergence from their den of hockey hibernation to the top of the standings. Also ahead, the 9th annual Santa Speedo Run, where love is in the cold, cold air.
You know, because you're dressed so scantily, you kind of see what you're getting involved in.
You can really find the love of your life in the Santa Speedo Run.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The winter is looking dreary indeed in Dallas, but just dandy in Detroit. Obviously, I'm not talking about the weather, but about the performance of the NHL teams in those two cities. And there are a lot of teams and cities in between. So joining me now to engage in some more good hockey talk is the devastating doyen of deking herself, Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Helene, welcome back to the program.
I sure look forward to those creative intros. Thank you.
Well, I came up with that one all by myself, too.
Wow, you get a gold star, and I bet Santa will be nice to you.
I hope so. We should start with the NHL's best team right now, the Sharks. They've accumulated a staggering 53 points with a 25-4-3 record. What is in the water that the Sharks are swimming in there in San Jose?
Well, they've got a new coach, and players are always eager to kind of impress a new coach. And he's put in a few new system changes. But, you know, for the last, like, 4 or 5 years, the Sharks have been the, you know, sexy pick for all the people who do their preseason predictions. And I've somehow resisted because there's always been something missing there. I don't know if it's hard, if it's just the toughness that you need to get through long playoffs. And they just have always been upset. You know, the second round seems to be their end point every year. I'm not quite convinced about them yet. And they got spanked by Detroit the other day. So let's just wait and see on the Sharks. I'm not ready quite to go with the flow on the Sharks yet.
Well, as you mentioned, said Sharks lost 6-0 to Detroit on Thursday night. The Wings have gotten off to a very good start. Do they sustain it?
I think they do. You know, there's this whole thing of the Stanley Cup hangover, which means that, you know, you go through so much to win the cup, and it's so tiring and takes so much out of you that you just don't have the recovery time over the summer that you really need to get a good start the following season. But actually, this season started a little later, so the season wasn't quite so short for the Red Wings. And just the depth they have, and Marian Hossa, and just the way they play, they're so smart. They conserve energy. They just know when to turn it on. They can turn it on and off, although that's kind of dangerous. Coaches hate to see that, but these guys can do it, and they just have the depth. They have the experience. I really like that team. I think that they're going to really go far and may even just win it again.
The Blackhawks are playing well of late. Are fans in Chicago surprised, or did they expect this?
Well, with all the advertising and the hype and everything that's been going on around that team, the Blackhawks had to play well. You know, it's really been an amazing turnaround there, and it's been terrific to see. You know, for years that franchise was just dead. They weren't on TV locally. Nobody cared. Then when Mr. Wirtz passed away and the management changed, and they brought in John McDonough, who had been with the Cubs, pulled off some incredible advertising campaigns, put them on television. What a concept. And they rediscovered their audience. I mean, people rediscovered Blackhawks hockey. They also have some very good young players in Taves and Kane and some other kids who really have the goods.
If not for the extraordinary season that San Jose is enjoying, the Bruins, currently atop the Eastern Conference at 22-5-4, would be the hottest team in the league right now. How has this year's squad succeeded after so many years of relative futility?
The great story has been Tim Thomas, and just, you know, this guy's been through so much over the years, having an incredible season now. It's fun to see, you know, people talk about the original six teams and how much they mean to the NHL if those teams are doing well. And here you have Chicago doing well. You have Boston doing well. The Rangers are doing well. It's really kind of fun to see franchises that have struggled for a while kind of pick themselves up and get in there and be competitive. And, you know, they're major markets. From what I understand, the TV ratings have been good, and local TV ratings have been good in a lot of places. So, you know, the NHL is doing its part to entertain people here.
The Dallas Stars were a perennial power in the NHL's Western Conference, but they find themselves at the bottom of their division. What's happened in Dallas?
I could give you a two-word answer, and that would be Sean Avery, who just totally disrupted that team. One of the worst free agent signings ever in the history of the NHL, and there is quite a long history of bad free agent signings in that league. He's just a divisive, polarizing force, totally disrupted the chemistry in that room. Plus, you know, they did lose some players to injury. Zubov ended up having to have hip surgery. They lost Mietinen, and it just turned into a completely different team this season. And then Sean Avery walked in and disrupted everything, and it really hasn't helped at all.
Helene, I read an interesting article in the Boston Globe this week by Fluto Shinzawa that addressed the issue of what he called fight etiquette, hockey fight etiquette. Are you aware of such a phenomenon?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, whether the fighters will talk among themselves of, you know, do you want to drop the gloves? No, I don't want to drop the gloves now. You want to go in the third period? Okay, we'll go in the third period. That kind of thing. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's all these rules, and, you know, if you hit our star, we'll hit your star, and that's okay. And it's just kind of very bizarre. If you're not a hockey fan and you see this, you go, what in the world is going on here?
Helene Elliott covers the NHL for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks, Helene, and I hope your holidays are full of nothing but hat tricks.
Same to you. Thank you.
Next up is a Zdeno Chara autograph stick. That goes to 1809. Once again, Zdeno autograph stick, 1809.
On Sunday, at the raffle of Boston Bruins souvenirs held during a practice open to season ticket holders, the Zdeno Chara autograph stick went to Mike Penta, who couldn't have been more pleased.
It gets put up in my room, and it, you know, gets locked up with the rest of the stuff that I get. Look, but don't touch.
This is not going on eBay.
No, definitely not.
Absolutely not.
Definitely not.
Absolutely not.
No.
Mike Penta was attending the practice with his wife, his sister, and his brother-in-law, all of them dressed in Bruins black and gold. Penta has been a Bruins fan for years, but somehow he knew this season would be different.
I've always come to Bruins games, but this is the first year that I actually got season tickets before the season even started. I mean, I come to the games all the time, but I just felt this is the year I should get the tickets.
The Bruins have been making Mike Penta's decision look very good. In the early going, they've built the best record in the NHL's Eastern Conference, and thanks in large part to the 6'9" Zdeno Chara, no team has allowed fewer goals than Boston. In the locker room after Sunday's practice, Chara, who was born in Slovakia, said he'd been aware of fans like Mike Penta for a long time.
Of course I'm aware of that. You know, I know before I was coming over here, I knew that Boston is very sports-oriented city, and fans are very passionate about it, and so I know it's a lot of history in here. That's one of the reasons why I decided to come play for Boston, because I believe that there is potential and possibilities, so for sure I want to be here, and hopefully we can accomplish that.
Get it to be a Bruins town again.
Yeah, for sure.
That has been a challenge, certainly. Boston's other winter team, the Celtics, are the NBA's defending champions. The Patriots have won 3 Super Bowls in the young century. The Red Sox, long a dependable foil for any local team that could capture a championship, won the World Series in 2004 and again in 2007. The Bruins last won hockey's Stanley Cup 36 years ago, during the storied days of Bobby Orr, Phil Esposito, and Derek Sanderson. though current Bruins coach Claude Julien feels it's early to be anticipating the return of the Stanley Cup to Boston. In the corridor outside the locker room after Sunday's practice, he acknowledged that his club is where he wants it to be.
Well, I think there's definitely confidence in that dressing room, confidence that we are as good as any team in this league right now. And, you know, it's a matter of going out there every night and proving it. Having taken that approach also has helped bring a lot of the fans back. I mean, everybody supports a winner. This city is no different, and they've gotten used to having winning teams, and we all know who those teams are. So now it's a matter of us jumping on the bandwagon that way and being part of that group.
There's considerable reason to conclude that as far as fans of the 08-09 Bruins are concerned, the team has already joined that group. Season ticket sales are up, as are sellouts at home, but those are only numbers. According to Shira Springer, the National Enterprise sports writer for the Boston Globe, anecdotal evidence involving Bruins forward Milan Lucic supports that conclusion, too.
I was at a fan event a couple weeks ago, and there was a family that had gone to see Santa that morning, and they had done what they thought was going to be their Christmas card photo op, and so they had posed the children nicely on Santa's lap, and they got to this fan event, and there was Milan Lucic, and they thought it would be nice to snap a quick picture with Lucic, and they did, and they took a look on their digital camera, and the husband goes, "That's the Christmas card. Forget Santa."
Forget Santa? Today's Bruins are encouraging fans to forget Santa? This is perhaps not something general manager Peter Chiarelli would want to hear. His contention is that the greatest strength of the current team is what he calls their lunch pail character. Chiarelli, who came to the Bruins in May of 2006 from the front office of the Ottawa Senators, has had a lot to do with returning Boston's team to the ethic that characterized successful Bruins teams of the past, teams on which even the stars, like Bobby Orr, put hard work ahead of celebrity. Chiarelli says now that he could see as early as the beginning of last season that this team could bring enthusiasm for pro hockey back to Boston.
Last year we talked about flying under the radar. Let's surprise some teams because we know that we do have some ability to go places. And this year we're no longer under the radar. But I still like, you know, the lunch pail approach. Let's come to work every day. Let's get our game, like, you know, let's perform. And, you know, at the end of the day, hopefully we'll have something to speak for it.
One of the former Bruins upon whom Chiarelli might have based his blueprint for the current team is Cam Neely, the exceptionally productive and very popular former forward whose 10-year career with Boston ended in 1996. Now a vice president with the Bruins, Neely knows as well as anyone in the organization how the team can excite the city, which in turn can inspire the team.
And it's exciting for me to see the fan base come back and support the team. Because I know what it was like as a player to play in front of a full house. And in Boston, there's nothing better than, you know, I mean, our fans make a huge difference when they're in the building and the team is playing well. It makes a huge difference.
That's how the difference sounded on Thursday night, while the Bruins were burying the Toronto Maple Leafs under 8 goals, 2 of them in the first few minutes of the game. The 17,565 fans gathered in the TD Bank North Garden that night to see Boston win their 12th straight at home, cheered every rush up ice, every goal, and, of course, every fight. For the first time in years in Boston, there's a sense that this sound might carry through the long New England winter and into the spring. It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Check my custom machine.
You can wear a rubber dog mask at a Cleveland Browns game. You can bang on the back of the seat in front of you with a big pseudo bone and howl like a hound driven mad by the moon. However, you can't drive a couch into the parking lot of Cleveland Browns Stadium before the game, even if said couch is laden with people who've bought tickets. Just ask Mike Meredith, who wheeled his go-couch, which he built by attaching a riding mower to a sofa, into the lot outside the stadium for a game against Houston. Meredith was shocked to receive 2 traffic tickets, since before the Cleveland police officer with no sense of humor cited him, several other officers had waved and laughed as he drove around the lot. Fellow tailgaters have contributed over $500 to defray whatever fines Mike Meredith may face. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Rosen chronicles the first days of the NBA. But first, the Arena Football League had been growing rapidly for the past 22 years. In fact, it grew to 16 teams, and last year saw an increase in attendance, TV ratings, and merchandise sales. So why did the AFL announce this week that it's canceling the 2009 season? For an answer, we've called Dean Jackson, who has broadcast arena football games and hosted a weekly podcast devoted to arena and indoor football games. Dean, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, thank you for having me on the program.
For the benefit of listeners who are not familiar with the Arena Football League, tell me a little bit about the appeal of the game and who buys tickets.
Well, arena football kind of billed itself as rock and roll football. If you can imagine football on the dimensions of an ice hockey rink, you put some AstroTurf down there, put some bumper boards on the side with padding, you get a combination of football, basketball, hockey, indoor soccer, you throw in a rebound net, that's what you have in arena football.
What was the problem with the expenses? It can't be that arena football players were overpaid, can it?
Well, that's a great question. 20 years ago when the league started, it was largely hitting $500, maybe $1,000 a game, and I don't have the salaries right in front of me. But arena football brought in a players' union. Well, players brought in the union, I should say. That's the NFL Players Union. And we got quarterbacks that were making $150,000, $200,000, $300,000 a year to play arena football. And you've got franchises that grew in value, granted, from $500,000 to upwards of $10, $12, $15, maybe even $20 million. A lot of that value is because that's what you have to pay the players.
Mm. At least one report suggests that the push to cancel the season came from owners in Dallas and Colorado, where Jerry Jones and Pat Bowlen respectively happen to own NFL franchises on the side. In the past, the AFL has pursued a stronger relationship with the National Football League. Was that a mistake?
I think there has been a push over the years to make the AFL like NFL too. And you get guys in Colorado, John Elway, Bowlen. You got Arthur Blank, who also owns the Atlanta Falcons, who has a team in Atlanta, Jerry Jones in Dallas, and they're the ones who are now starting to say, hey, we really can't make money at this thing that we want to be an owner at. I would not be too surprised if we saw this league come back with a lower structure of salaries, maybe even in an extent to bust the players' union. I'm not so certain it's not going to come back, but the Arena Football League, like we know it, probably will not exist come next year.
Columbus Destroyers co-owner Jim Renacci is in charge of the reconstruction, and he says he'll be looking for ways to economize, so maybe you're right, but he'll also be looking for outside investment. Renacci says the goal is to bring the league back better and possibly bigger for 2010, but I wonder, do fans believe that? Do they come back, especially the season ticket holders?
I will say this about arena football fans. They are extremely loyal. They know the players. They know the game. But I don't know that in today's economy, with today's fickle nature of fans, and arena football like to think of itself as the fifth or sixth major league sport, but as much as I love the game, I can't say that it really is one of those five or six spots that are, you know, right next to hockey and football and basketball and baseball. I don't know it's there, and I don't know that taking a year off is going to help them stay in the minds of the fans. Now, here's the other wrinkle that nobody's talking about. And I've done a few years of games for leagues like United Indoor Football, the Indoor Football League, or the American Indoor Football Association, or the Great Lakes Football League. And I think the Arena Football League has to realize, too, that they can't be away too long because that's only going to give more power to these leagues.
Fans of indoor football are not entirely without a product this season, Dean. Arena Football 2 says that they'll be going ahead with their season in March, which confuses me. How can Arena Football 2 go on without Arena Football the original, or does Arena Football 2 become Arena Football 1?
Well, that's a great question. I'm also told, and I have not seen this memo personally, but I am told that from the Arena 2 office, no team is allowed to sign an AFL player. However, I'm hearing a number of teams, well, at least a couple teams in the other indoor leagues signing arena teams. For example, there's a team in St. Louis that signed the AFL Rookie of the Year last year, or very close to signing that Rookie of the Year from the AFL. So I think there's going to be a trickle-down for those other leagues, and I think it's only going to be a matter of time before the AF2 says, okay, we got to start signing those players because we don't want them to go outside the quote-unquote arena football family.
One wonders how long it would be before there would be a court test for that. How can a team that's defunct tell its former players they can't take a job somewhere else?
And I don't think that could stand the test. That's the point. I've had that discussion with friends of mine with teams that wondered just how strong such an enforcement would be. Hmm.
All sports leagues are tightening their belts, of course. We've seen staffing cuts in the NBA, the NFL, and in Major League Baseball. But this is the first league that has actually suspended the season altogether. I wonder if there will be more cancellations to follow.
Well, I think we will see a number of minor league teams go under. It's just a matter of how strong the individual teams are and how savvy they are in their particular market.
Dean Jackson has served as a play-by-play announcer for indoor football. Dean, thank you very much for joining me.
Bill, thank you for having me on the program.
Years ago, the Pro Basketball League that would become the NBA staged their first games. According to Maurice Podoloff, the commissioner of the adventure, it was, quote, a complete failure. Nor was Commissioner Podoloff speaking strictly in terms of the league's finances, though four of the original teams folded after that first season. The games were lousy, Podoloff acknowledged years later. That was my lasting memory of that season. Lousy games. Why, then, would anybody want to recall those bygone days in a book? Charlie Rosen, the author of the first tip-off, The Incredible Story of the Birth of the NBA, joins me now from WAMC in Albany, New York, to answer that question. Charlie, welcome back to Only a Game.
Okay, Bill, thank you.
The league that began playing in November 1946 was not the first experiment in professional basketball. What was the landscape of the pro game like before 1946?
There were literally dozens of pro leagues, mostly in the Northeast, some in the Midwest. They were all kind of fly-by-night organizations where players would jump from one team to another team, sometimes right before a game. Teams, they'd sell themselves to the highest bidder. Teams would fold and be replaced and move from one city to the next. Nobody made any money. And when the BAA first came into existence, the main competition was a league called the National Basketball League, which probably had the better players, but played in smaller cities like Oshkosh and Syracuse and Rochester.
One of the problems nearly all the franchises in the BAA faced resulted from their status as tenants in buildings where the main attraction was ice hockey. What could possibly go wrong with that arrangement?
Well, the owners of the BAA teams either owned or controlled hockey teams, and they also either owned or controlled the arenas. So they thought, at least at the beginning of the season, that they could just throw the basketball court down on top of the ice and start playing. More people came into the building. The ice started to melt and seep up through the floorboards. So players were sliding all over the place and tripping, and it was really a mess. But also, because the owners were in the hockey business, at the beginning of the season, they instructed the referees to let everything go. No blood, no foul. Just about anything went.
If a contemporary fan could return to the fall of 1946 to witness one game in the old BAA, what would most surprise him or her?
Well, there was no 24-second clock, of course, but the ball was totally different. It was significantly larger, and there were stitches on the outside to close it up. And because of the laces, if you bounce the ball and hit the laces, it would bounce askew. So every dribble was an adventure. So the modern fan would be surprised to see wobbling shots that would veer off 10 degrees to the right or 10 degrees to the left. Nobody dunked the ball because it was just too difficult to palm because it was so big and so heavy. And because of all these factors, anybody who shot 30% was considered to be a dead-eye shooter.
Some of the players from that first season characterized the fans as, quote, too enthusiastic, your words. What was the evidence of that?
Well, particularly in Philadelphia, referees and opposing players sometimes, if the visiting team won, would have to fight their way off the court. But also in Washington, I believe, the wires holding the basket steady were attached to the mezzanine. So fans would run up and shake the wires, which would then shake the baskets while the visiting team was shooting.
Considerably harder to hit a moving target.
Yeah, absolutely.
Red Auerbach coached one of the teams in the ABA's first season, the Washington Capitals, and of course he went on to great success with the Boston Celtics. But you found evidence that Coach Auerbach was not universally regarded as a genius in those early days. How was he regarded?
Well, he kind of, first of all, talked himself into the job. He was a mediocre college player at George Washington University. And during the war, World War II, he coached a Navy team. And he came into the owner's office, Mike Uihlein, the owner of the Washington Capitals, and said, hire me and I can bring all the guys who played for me in the Navy onto your team. So Uihlein hired him. And indeed, he brought a whole bunch of guys with him. They were very good players. But Auerbach, even though his knowledge of the game was kind of iffy, was a loudmouth, foul-mouth presence on the bench, screaming, cursing at referees, cursing at his own players. He got on one of his players, Freddie Scolari, so badly. He kept on saying, I'm better than you. You stink, Scolari. And they actually played a game of one-on-one in which Scolari beat him 15-0, but it didn't stop Auerbach from abusing him. But Auerbach was so out of control that after one game, he burst into the officials' locker room and wanted to fight one of the officials.
The man upon whom the success of the league, such as it was, rested was Joe Foulkes, a devastating offensive force for the Philadelphia Warriors. To what lengths did the commissioner go to make sure that fans got to see plenty of Foulkes?
Well, the referees were under instruction not to let Foulkes foul out. So Foulkes never fouled out. And the referees were also told to make sure that Foulkes shot a whole bunch of free throws. And he averaged 23.2. And the second highest scorer in the league was Bob Ferrick, who averaged 16.8. Foulkes was considered to be a freak. To someone to score that many points was like a baseball player averaging 2 home runs every game.
Given Commissioner Podoloff's own contention that the games were lousy, and given that almost all the teams lost money, 4 of them, so much money that they went out of business, how did the league survive to stage season number 2?
They had a lot of money behind it because Ned Irish, to a certain degree, he bankrolled the league that first season, especially toward the end when a lot of other teams couldn't meet their payrolls. Things started to come together when the rival league, the NBL, started to fold, and the BAA took over 4 or 5 franchises, including the Minneapolis Lakers, which featured George Mikan. And then the college basketball scandals, which broke in 1951, really discredited college basketball. So they struggled for quite a while.
Given how popular and how profitable the NBA is now, I'm wondering, should aspiring sports leagues take heart from the rather unprepossessing start of pro basketball?
I don't think so, because the professional leagues in the various major sports are so well entrenched and are so successful that there really isn't a leftover audience. When the BAA began, there really was no major competition. As I said, the NBA was in small cities.
Charlie Rosen is the author of The First Tip-Off, The Incredible Story of the Birth of the NBA, published by McGraw-Hill. He joined me from WAMC in Albany, New York. Charlie, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to Only a Game. My conversation last week with Gary Andrew Poole, the author of a new biography of Illinois football legend Red Grange, inspired nostalgic musing in John H. Wild, who hears only a game on WEPR in Greenwood, South Carolina. My father was a Michigan student in 1924, Mr. Wild wrote. He usually worked Saturdays, but he had the day off when Illinois came to town, and so he went to the game. 60 years later, he was still talking about what Red Grange did to Michigan that day, although he downgraded Grange's accomplishment by reminding his listeners that Michigan didn't have a very good team that year. For the record, what Red Grange did that day was run and pass for 402 yards, scoring 5 touchdowns in the process. Bonnie Ryan, who lives in North Tonawanda, New York, was not entirely delighted by our conversation about the football team at Ball State University. I must say that I was most disappointed that Mr. Littlefield failed to mention that the University of Buffalo football team defeated Ball State in the Mid-American Conference Championship game, she wrote. This was a monumental victory for the University of Buffalo, the last Buffalo team to be invited to a bowl game, the Tangerine Bowl, in 1958, declined the invitation because they would not have been allowed to bring 2 black players who were members of that team. This is the 50th anniversary of this courageous act, and I think it would make a very worthwhile story. In fact, we did acknowledge the loss to Buffalo in that story last week, but we didn't get into that proud moment in Buffalo's history. I'm glad to have had the opportunity to do that now. We also got an email from another listener who was skeptical about our Ball State conversation. Neil Roundtree of McCall, Idaho, wrote as follows, "You failed to ask the reporter from Muncie, Indiana, about Ball State's refusal to play Boise State in the Humanitarian Bowl. Kind of smells like chicken." Finally, we received an email from John McLaughlin, who lives in Richmond, Vermont. Mr. McLaughlin apparently favors the preemptive strike school of correspondence. He wrote, "I hope this winter, when I am driving my kids to the ski races, we don't have to listen to Only a Game slam Bodie Miller." Gee, I wasn't even thinking of doing that this winter, but, maybe. You can let us know what you think of our stories by leaving a message on the listener line, 617-353-1860. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can send us a letter at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The first round of the Dunhill Championship at the Leopards Creek Golf Club in Malalane, South Africa, was predictably populated by birdies, and it featured the odd eagle as well. Unhappily for Robert Rock, the tournament's animal population also included one of Africa's most venomous reptiles, a black mamba. It was between the 7th green and the 8th tee, Rock said. There were a couple of people poking around after it. I gave it a bit of a wide berth. Scared me off a bit. But just a bit, as it turned out, and only temporarily. Rock totaled 7 birdies on the day and finished the tournament tied for second at 16 under par. Good for a payday of 92,100 euros.
Draw back in the drown, cause I'm crawling again.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, See Santa Run. Ooh, Santa looks cold. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Stephon Marbury banished by the Knicks last month after he declined to accept the coach's invitation to enter a game against the Pistons, bought a ticket, and attended the Lakers-Knicks game in Los Angeles Tuesday night. Which team do you suppose he was rooting for?
Marbury was dead. Of that, there is no doubt. Anyway, yeah, I think he was just being a nudge, actually, to Mike D'Antoni. And there, he doesn't have a lot of vehicles by which he can be a nudge to Mike D'Antoni anymore. And this was one he actually went into his own pocket for.
I don't know the stats right offhand, Charlie, but is the NBA on course to set a record for number of coaches fired during a season?
Six before Christmas is really quite something, actually. That's vintage George Steinbrenner, Ted Stepien-esque panic. That's almost Al Davis panic, but not quite there. The interesting thing is Lonnie Cooper and the Career Sports and Entertainment Management Company Atlanta, they represented all six of these guys. Boy, are they busy. To be fair, they also represent Doc Rivers, and he seems to be safe.
That's right. The last surviving member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame's inaugural class died on Wednesday night, Sammy Baugh. He was 94 years old. Sammy Baugh was an exceptionally successful quarterback, but he was one of those players who was said to be able to do anything on a football field, and in the era when he played, you had to be.
He played both ways. He's still the only person ever to lead the league in passing yardage, punting, and interceptions by. He had 31 interceptions as a Redskin, which places him to this day third on the team's list. Plus, he was an epic giant figure in the Neolithic era of professional football. He was a reference point. I am old enough to remember when people would say, who does he think he is, Sammy Baugh? He had an incredibly funky throwing motion. If you ever watched the video of him, the Slinging Sammy was not a nickname. It wasn't just because he threw the ball a lot. It was because he seemed to start throwing it from behind his opposite shoulder.
Joe Paterno will be 82 years old tomorrow, and this week he got an early birthday present, a 3-year contract extension at Penn State. You'll be surprised, I'm sure, to hear that Coach Paterno was vague when asked how long he would continue to coach.
Well, we know he can coach for another 3 years. Penn State has now locked itself into an incredible position with this guy because his team was really good this year. They're one bad 2 or 3 minutes against Iowa from being undefeated and playing for the national championship. Now they're going to play Southern Cal in the Rose Bowl. You cannot very well force a guy into retirement when he goes 11-1 and playing in the Rose Bowl, unless, of course, you're Auburn. But now they've committed to Joe Paterno through 85. And this is a guy who doesn't even make it to the sidelines anymore until he's 85.
Florida quarterback Tim Tebow, who will try to lead Florida to the national title on January 8th, says that he hasn't thought about whether he will enter the 2009 NFL draft, but he sure is curious about where he might go in that draft if he does decide to enter it. Does this seem as strange to you as it does to me?
Well, I think it's just idle curiosity. I don't care what my involvement in this event would be, but I wonder what my involvement in this event would be.
I wonder how much money I might make.
This is being maximum coy. But given the fact that he was nearly the Heisman Trophy winner again, his team is playing for another national championship, he'd be foolish not to check something out.
Charlie, last week, the group called Black Coaches and Administrators opened a national telephone hotline offering legal advice to coaches, a move BCA Executive Director Floyd Keith says could lead to a federal lawsuit against universities that fail to hire minority coaches and administrators. What is the basis for this potential legal action?
Well, they're going to apply under Title VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act. I think the proximate cause of the sudden interest in this, again, is the absurd situation at Auburn where Tommy Tuberville got fired. They hired a coach from Iowa State who had a record miserably below 500 as opposed to Turner Gill, who turned things around at Buffalo. I think that there's probably a civil rights case here. The problem is, if you're going to go to court with it, it better be, pardon the expression, a slam dunk. And I don't think they're going to find one of those very easily.
It was announced on Thursday that NASCAR has settled with a former official who had filed a $225 million discrimination and harassment lawsuit. Terms were not disclosed. But how far do you think this settlement will go toward defining the, quote, new NASCAR?
Well, it was a case that had to be gotten rid of. I will guarantee you that NASCAR wrote a very, very healthy check to Maurizio Grant, who was the person who sued, claiming incredibly lewd and sort of disgusting sexual harassment happened to her while she was working for NASCAR. The problem, of course, with the new NASCAR is that it's no more economically supportable than the old NASCAR was and has its own trouble right now.
Well, also on Thursday, Dodge Motorsports announced that Chrysler will slash its 2009 NASCAR budget by 30%. I wonder, does that mean that their cars will travel at an average speed of 114 miles an hour rather than 170?
I don't know that, but I mean, given the fact that Chrysler is pretty much shutting down its American operations for a few days, and there's no indication that the American operations will open anytime soon, I think the fact that it's slashing its budget but is going to stay in NASCAR strikes me as just a little bit contrary to the spirit of the season.
Last week we talked about those blinking red warning lights on the website of the Arena Football League, and I guess they've gone out.
Yeah, there will be no Arena Football in 2009, and I feel really bad for this because it was actually a very fun take for people with their families. I've been to a few of Arena Football games. It never extended itself too much. It didn't claim to be anything more than a really crazy niche sport for places that doesn't have real football, and it just didn't have enough. I mean, there was just not enough money behind it to make a go of it.
I am generally not a fan of domed buildings for sports meant to be played outside, Charlie, but I'm ready to make an exception for Wimbledon. How about you?
I guess they're just very tired of having to extend the Wimbledon fortnight to a month and a half and play 900 matches in one day. On May 17th, they're going to see whether the retractable roof is going to work over center court. It always rains during this tournament. This is probably a bow to the inevitable, but I guarantee you there are many purists in England who are not happy.
And finally, among the more unlikely metaphorical pairings I can imagine are NFL linebacker and daytime soap star, but just such a pairing was in fact suggested this week by the football player. What did London Fletcher of Washington have in mind?
Well, very secure in his masculinity, as we can tell, London Fletcher decided that he was the, quote, Susan Lucci of the NFL because he was once again not picked for the Pro Bowl, even though he's done a tremendous job at his position for 11 years. I think it's kind of an odd comparison, but I admire his ability to reach beyond the football field for his metaphors.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His metaphors are terrific, by the way, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Happy holidays, Charlie.
Happy holidays, Bill, and happy holidays to everybody in the extended Only a Game family.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcasts. What do skimpy bathing suits, jogging, and jolly old St. Nick have in common? We sent Only a Game's Doug Tribou out to find the answer.
It's a Saturday in mid-December. The skies over downtown Boston are clear, and the temperature is about 27 degrees. Boston resident Megan Coffey and Elizabeth Barry of Bedford, Massachusetts, have their running shoes on, and they have some advice on staying warm.
Jumping up and down.
Keep moving.
Doing jumping jacks, doing whatever it takes.
27 degrees isn't that extreme for dedicated runners, but Coffey and Barry are wearing only bikinis. They're two of more than 500 people stripping down for the 9th annual Santa Speedo Run, a mile and a quarter jog in which runners are encouraged to wear bathing suits and accessorize with holiday flair. Runners are registering inside Lear, a three-story bar on Boylston Street in the Back Bay, one of Boston's most popular shopping districts. John Iannelli is the run's co-founder and organizer. He says the idea was born when he and four friends were trying to come up with a practical joke.
We picked a weekend, we did it. We tried to recruit a whole bunch of people, and it was still just the five of us because everyone else was afraid. And so we ran down the street wearing Santa hats, Speedos, and carried a jukebox with a CD of the Muppets singing Christmas carols.
The stunt got a lot of reaction, and the men decided to turn it into a charitable event. The following year, they were up to 30 runners and raised about $2,000.
The fourth year I was in grad school, I had a little extra free time on my hands, and decided to just put some more structure to it, an organization, built a website, put some minimums on what people needed to raise in order to participate.
The event has snowballed since then, and in 2007 raised $90,000.
Come on, let's go.
Today's start time is 2 hours away, but many runners are down to their swimsuits already and downing some liquid courage. Most runners get creative with their outfits. Judy Jakes of Newton, Massachusetts, describes hers.
A little Santa outfit with a lot of marabou around the edges, a red and black feather boa, a leopard print Santa hat, and a bell.
There's also a man covered in green paint with garlands and lights wrapped around his torso doing his best Christmas tree impersonation. Several women dressed as does have brown knit hats with ears and matching miniskirts with cotton tails. Kyle and Lana Grady of Somerville, Massachusetts, met at the 2005 race and were married this May. Kyle was wearing only a Speedo, sneakers, and a Santa hat, when he introduced himself to his future wife.
You know, because you're dressed so scantily, you kind of see what you're getting involved in.
All of your questions are sort of answered up front. Is that the idea?
Bingo.
You can really find the love of your life at the Santa Speedo Run.
As the start time approaches, runners pour out into the street, and there's a lot of laughing, shivering, and calisthenics. When the run begins, hundreds of friends and family members line the sidewalks along the course. Organizer John Iannelli serves as the pace runner behind a police escort. It's not a race, and Iannelli stops the pack several times to do push-ups and put on a show while slower runners catch up. He says it's hard to keep the more eager exhibitionists from sprinting ahead.
The conflict there is that it's 27 degrees outside right now, and it's pretty cold, and it's a mile, and so even though it's a lot of people run outside in the winter when you're only wearing the Speedo, there's the urge to want to go faster, so it's a challenge to, you know, keep people under control that way.
The run ends where it began, and the party continues. One of the oldest runners is Leon Warner, and he's also traveled further than most. His home state, Nevada, and his age, 69, are painted across his stomach in blue. Warner ran last year and says he couldn't wait to come back.
Oh, I love it. I think this is the greatest thing that ever happened. I give to charities back home. My son lives here and he wants me to come and run with him. So I give to his charities and the things that he wants to do.
Every year, John Iannelli chooses one local children's charity small enough to benefit significantly from the fundraiser. Today's recipient is Cradles to Crayons, which distributes new and used goods to children in need. Chris Bentman manages corporate relations for Cradles to Crayons.
It only costs us about $25 to outfit one child with a package of clothes, books, toys, and everything that child needs to get through a cold Northeast winter. So with the money that we'll raise here today, it's simple math. For every $25 that we raise, that's one more child that we can help.
The next day, Iannelli reports online donations and runners' collections will be more than $175,000, nearly double last year's total. And that means a bunch of people running around in their bathing suits in December will help about 7,000 children. And was the Santa Speedo Run everything first-time runners Elizabeth Berry and Megan Coffey expected it to be?
Oh my gosh.
Way more.
It, way better.
Yeah,
way.
It ended up actually being not as cold as I thought it was going to be.
No, everybody's in the spirit. It's just such a great
it's
time.
It's for a good cause, yes. So it's really well worth it.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
The Santa Speedo Run appealed to all of us at Only a Game as a story possibility. How could it have been otherwise? We're the people who brought you skillet tossing, underwater hockey, belt sander racing, wife carrying, and things of that nature. How could we not have been intrigued by the story of lots of people running through the streets of an eastern city in December in their bathing suits? But there was more to this event than the self-evident charm of its absurdity. During these days of diminishing assets, all of us at Only a Game were encouraged not only by the goofiness of the Santa Speedo Run, but by its success. The event raised nearly twice as much money for charity as it did last year, even though last year almost everybody was feeling more prosperous than they are now. The Santa Speedo Run is not unique, except for how cold the people participating in it get. It's not even unusual. Lots of athletes and quasi-athletes run and swim and walk and ride bicycles for charity, and lots of their friends and family members and associates and people who work on the other side of the partition from them contribute $5 or $25 to recognize the efforts of these athletes. Much has been written about how good the residents of a city can be made to feel by the success of that city's team of highly paid professional athletes. Nobody who's watched the celebrations following the conclusion of a World Series or the NBA Finals or the Super Bowl can deny that particular aspect of the power of sports. But we recognize, too, and we applaud, the power of our games and competitions to energize the inclination toward giving. For this reason, when the next runner or walker or swimmer or rider we know or don't tries to hit us up for a contribution to this hospital or to that research fund or to the other collection on behalf of those who have less than they need, we'll try not to respond like the unreconstructed Scrooge who wished to be left alone, but like his cheerful nephew Fred, who, no matter his own modest circumstances, always thought of Christmas as a charitable time. I bet Fred would have cheered the Santas as they raced by in their Speedos, and he'd have dropped what he could spare into the old man's hat as well. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Erica Bailey and from Stacy Perry at WAMC in Albany. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you dare view Doug Trabu's Santa Speedo Run photo gallery, or you want to see my Boston Bruins pictures, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Chris Bentman of Cradles to Crayons, who anticipates the start of the 9th annual Santa Speedo Run.
There's a man standing next to me who's pretty much naked, just wearing a cowboy hat, and he seems to be ready to go.
Excuse me, Mr. Bentman, if that really is your name, but this is the Santa Speedo Run, not the Buckaroo Speedo Run. That's underway in Rancho Cucamonga, even as we speak. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.